Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The 1964 Historic Wilderness Act designated 9.1 million acres of wild lands into the National Wilderness Preservation System. Since then, 100 million more acres of wilderness has been designated as federally protected and preserved unspoiled wild land, which covers about 5% of the land in the U.S. Roughly 50% of it is in Alaska. The Wilderness Act has been described as one of the most eloquently written pieces of legislation in the U.S. It calls for the preservation and protection of some of the most natural and undisturbed places. In his new book, Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man, today's guest, environmental journalist Jason Mark, writes, quote, "On this overheated and overcrowded planet, priorities are changing. The old faith in the value of wildness is melting under the glare of a hot new sky. For many people, including those who call themselves environmentalists, human self-preservation now trumps the preservation of wild nature," end quote. So how has climate change, overpopulation, and our human footprint changed the meaning of wilderness? What does wildness or wilderness mean today, and how has our relationship with it changed over time? Today, we're joined by Jason Mark. He's a Bay Area based environmental journalist. He's editor of Sierra Magazine, the Sierra Club's magazine, and he's co-founder of the Alemany Farm, San Francisco's largest urban farm. His book is called Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. And Jason joins me here in studio. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much. A lot of fun.
It's great to have you. So this is a really interesting conversation that has been going on since the 70s, because you had environmental philosophy movements like deep ecology and ecofeminism really grappling with these questions. And now that we know so much about ocean acidification, species extinction, climate change, you name it, this is a conversation that we really still need to be having. Why did you want to explore the concept of wildness at this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of comes from that quote that you just shared, and it's because of just the changing realities, again, of, you know, 8 billion people on the planet because of this existential threat of climate change, because of what we see happening increasingly with wildlife. You know, in my lifetime, humans have destroyed half of the wildlife on the planet. So even though things, yes, have been bad for quite a while, I think we're getting to some tipping points. And those tipping points, I think, are forcing a new conversation that I started to overhear. As an environmental journalist, I started to overhear first within the field of conservation biology, and then kind of trickling out sort of from academia into the mainstream. And this conversation about, yeah, where does wilderness and wildness fit if we, in fact, live on a planet that, you know, whether we like it or not, and we might not like it, is essentially entirely a human artifact. And so I wanted to kind of share that conversation with readers and kind of share it with a lay audience.
What really struck you when you were doing your research about what people said in the 70s? Because they were asking these really deep questions. What is our true relationship with the planet from a philosophical perspective? And so many of those questions can be applied to today, but we didn't have the information we have today back then about what we're really facing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what the book really gets at, is exactly where do we, meaning humans, fit in with wild nature, and how does wildness inform our relationship with the rest of nature? And again, in what some are calling the Anthropocene or the human age, this idea that we've entered this whole new geologic epoch, can wildness still serve as a touchstone for our relationship with nature? And so that's what I set out to explore. And yes, I mean, that was obviously, it's been a conversation, as you point out, you know, kind of since the deep ecology movement and Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation. I mean, it's always been part of the mix, but it's gotten a lot more pressing these days.
And you start your book out exploring the pretty heated battle over the Drake's Bay oyster farm in Point Reyes. For those of us who've kind of been following it on the edges but aren't in deep, it's really intense in Point Reyes. Give us a quick overview of what's happening there.
So I'll apologize in advance to listeners in West Marin who are tired of this conversation by now, but for the rest of Bay Area listeners might recall that, really for about 10 years, from basically about 2005 through basically 2012, there was a heated battle going on in Point Reyes about whether a long-standing oyster farm there in Drake's Estero should be allowed to continue operating. And it got very heated. And what I thought was so interesting was that everybody on all sides of that dispute loudly and proudly proclaimed themselves as environmentalists. So you had, on one side, the big conservation groups like the Sierra Club and NRDC and Center for Biological Diversity saying this oyster farm, which is essentially, this aquaculture operation, is inconsistent with the Wilderness Act and, in fact, is inconsistent with a deal that the oyster farm operators signed with the National Park Service. And then you had folks on the other side with equally solid, kind of green credentials, folks like Alice Waters and Michael Pollan, Peter Glick from the Pacific Institute, again, folks with really great environmental credentials saying, no, this is maybe the ideal of the green economy. We can have our wilderness and eat it too. And so you could just see in this one, it seemed very parochial, right? Like a battle royale over bivalves. But it casts into sharp relief how even people of shared values, their ideas of wild nature are changing today.
You interviewed a lot of people about this battle, and I want to read two quotes because I think it's really emblematic of the argument that you're making and the questions you say that we need to spend more time thinking about. So Amy Traynor was hired as the executive director of the West Marin Environmental Action Committee, and she told you, quote, "It gets back to the rights of nature. Do you believe we should incorporate ourselves into every ecosystem, or are some places sacred and special, places like this? Being able to come out here without the signs of this private operation, without man's fingerprints, to see it existing as it did for millennia. A lot of people don't see the value of that these days, but especially in this age of telecommunications, when we're always being pulled out of ourselves, this is a place where you can pull yourself inward. This is a sacred place. It's a church for many people, and I think that's more important than ever in this day." End quote. What really struck you about Amy Traynor's perspective on this battle?
Well, I think what struck me about Amy Traynor's perspective on this battle, and as I think the next line right after that is, I say you couldn't hope for a more eloquent or passionate defender of wild nature than Amy Traynor, who's still working out in West Marin today. And yet, I think it's fair to say that her arguments, as passionate and eloquent though they might have been, were unconvincing to many people in West Marin, where even today you see driving through Point Reyes and Inverness all of the Save Drake's Bay Oyster Farm signs. Now, again, for the record, in 2012, the Interior Department, officially pulled the lease, and just last year, the oyster farm shut its operations, and now I guess they're, pulling out the infrastructure there. According to one poll from the Marin IJ, it was a web poll, so you got to take it with a grain of salt, but according to a poll by the Marin IJ, 7 out of 10 people in West Marin, or in Marin, I guess, thought the oyster farm should stay. So again, that's what I thought was so interesting. I agree in large part with what Amy's saying. I think what's interesting is, again, even in a place like Bolinas, right, which has got it at its entrance a sign declaring that it is a socially acknowledged, nature-loving town, even in a place like that, not everybody totally agreed with Amy.
Well, and so you quote Phyllis Faber, who helped spearhead the effort to pass a state initiative, Prop 20, to put in place the nation's toughest coastal protection law. And you asked her the same question you asked Amy, and what exactly is she trying to protect? And she told you, this is Phyllis Faber, quote, "I'm trying to protect the ecosystem in Point Reyes. I'm trying to protect the coastal law. I'm trying to protect our community. The oyster farm does not damage the marine preserve. It benefits the marine preserve. It's the kayakers that disturb the harbor seal," she says. She also says it's a great benefit for people to come out, see a place that doesn't have houses all over the place, that doesn't have the signs of man. I think that's wonderful. But wilderness is different. It implies the absence of man, says Phyllis Faber.
Right. And again, Phyllis Faber is, again, something of, I guess you could say, like an eminence grise or a grand dame of California coastal protection. Again, helps spearhead the California Coastal Protection Act, was one of the founders of the Marin Agricultural Land Trust, and has been working to preserve, pastoral landscapes in West Marin, which are so important, I think, for Bay Area citizens who want open space. So again, you've got essentially kind of two giants of the Bay Area environmental community, again, kind of at cross purposes over this oyster farm. And I think, you know, Phyllis kind of teed it up there in terms of the book. I then went to some of the most rugged and remote places in America, went tracking wolves in the desert Southwest, rafted through the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, went to the Ho Rainforest, went to, again, these rugged and wild places to kind of see, you know, not necessarily who's right, because I think both Phyllis and Amy have got important grains of truth in what they're saying, but really kind of how to square the circle. Like, is there a way to hold on to that righteous sentimentality for wildness that Amy Traynor has and reconcile it with that sort of historical knowledge that Phyllis Faber is bringing into the conversation?
Does it matter where you are? Because Point Reyes, I mean, it's amazing. It's an hour drive from San Francisco, the Bay Area, right? So the population continues to explode here. There's so much traffic now. But you can drive an hour and really get away in the true sense of the word. So does it matter where you are and just how those people see, how they feel about protecting wildness?
Well, that's why I tried to, in the book, as much as it is anchored around our legally designated idea of wilderness and the Wilderness Act, I'm really trying to get at something more, and that's the idea of wildness. Mm. And wildness doesn't necessarily mean untouched. It doesn't necessarily mean pristine. What it means is undominated by human actions, that in this place, and normally we call that place a national park, we call that place a wilderness area, in this place, wherever we decide to draw the lines on the map, we're going to say beyond that line, we're not going to exercise deliberate control. Now, might we accidentally harm those places, again, through greenhouse gas emissions, through, again, sort of the biodiversity crisis that we're fueling? Yes, we're going to accidentally harm those areas. But there's a big difference, right, as any lawyer could tell you, between accident and intention. And I think in that difference between accident and intention lies our best chance for finding some way of living with grace on this planet. So that's what I was trying to get at. It's kind of, and again, wildness doesn't need to be far off and remote. Yes, there's a lot of wildness in Point Reyes National Seashore, and there's a lot of wildness in the East Bay Hills, right, where we now have mountain lions in the East Bay Hills. We've got mountain lions in, you know, on the peninsula, you know, a couple of mountain lion encounters just in the past year on the peninsula. So, and in fact, less than a year ago, last June, the first mountain lion spotted in the city of San Francisco in something like 80 years. Mm-hmm. So, no, you don't need to have a legally designated wilderness to find yourself in quite a wild place.
I'm speaking today with Jason Mark. He's a Bay Area-based journalist, environmentalist. He's editor of Sierra Magazine, Sierra Clubs Magazine, and he's out with a new book called Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What does wildness mean to you? And if you remember the conversations that were had in the 70s among environmental philosophers, they were asking these questions back then. What is our relationship with the planet from a philosophical perspective? Of course, we have so much more information today, but the questions are pretty much the same. What are your thoughts about this? Does the planet exist for our benefit? Do we have a responsibility and moral obligation to leave it untamed? How do you answer these questions? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you'd like to talk about a wild place that you have been recently, how it's changed over the years, I was just in Mendocino over the weekend and just jumping on a kayak. I mean, you're surrounded by so much wildness and beauty, and that hasn't changed much at all. I'm guessing because it's 3 hours away, there's not much development there, but we'd love to hear from you on these issues. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's talk a little bit about the Wilderness Act and how that's changed over the years, because you have right, it's been a huge success, far surpassing the original intentions of its framers. About 110 million acres of land in the U.S. are protected. That's about 5% of total U.S. land mass. When you factor out the vast wilderness areas of Alaska, 2% of the territory of the lower 48 is protected wilderness. What are your thoughts about how wildness has changed over that time since the Wilderness Act was passed?
Yeah, again, I think the most obvious one is just our increasing, even though, again, it's a huge accomplishment for the American environmental and conservation movement to have been able to protect 110 million acres. At the same time, the pressures on those areas are growing. Again, climate change is kind of the most obvious one. We can draw these two-dimensional lines on a map, but the threats today are multidimensional, and they're just going to jump over those lines. I mean, again, a wilderness boundary can stop a bulldozer from coming in, but it can't stop climate change from sort of vaulting over, mm-hmm. and we're already seeing the impacts of that. I mean, today, conservation biologists and other scientists know that there's no such thing, really. There's no place on the planet that's truly pristine. The human fingerprints are essentially everywhere. And I think that's, again, the thing that sort of trips us up sometimes the most is having to understand that it's not pristine, but it's still very wild. And that's the new understanding that's changing kind of how we the meanings that we give to wilderness and wildness. At the same time, though, our understanding of the law might change, I certainly would not, and I don't think any conservationists want any sort of rewrite or changing of the act, especially not in this political environment where what we would just see is a watering down of it. And I think it's great to even see, you know, within the outdoors community, there have been tensions over the years, you know, mountain bikers wanting to go into wilderness areas, and you can't take a mountain bike into a wilderness area. I mean, it's a wall against the wheel. You have to use primitive means of transportation only. That means your feet or an animal, right? And yet, you know, you even see the Mountain Biking Association saying, we don't want to see any rewrite of the Wilderness Act, because they know also that it would just be, you know, horribly watered down or, essentially destroyed in this political environment.
Again, the act defined wilderness as a place untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain, and a land retaining its influence without permanent improvements or habitation. And, of course, there's controversy even about that. We'll talk about that later, especially among Native Americans. But the question is, how does this work? This law work in today's time?
Oh, I think it works very well. And if anything, we need more wilderness areas. We need more parks and preserves for a number of reasons. But one of the most obvious is just for ecological and biological reasons. You know, conservation biologists have demonstrated that the parks and preserves that we have now, they're of limited efficacy just because they're not big enough, because of something called the edge effect, right? So they're essential but insufficient. So we need more parks, preserves, and wilderness areas, again, mostly to be able to create wildlife corridors. As climate change becomes more intense, flora and fauna, a lot of critters are going to be moving poleward and upward in slope. And what they're going to need are bigger protected areas, and protected areas that are connected, either, you know, probably in some sort of mosaic of public and private lands, hopefully getting, you know, some private landowners to create wildlife corridors, riparian corridors, working more closely with, you know, big landowners, especially in the agriculture industry, you know, farmers and ranchers. They're the ones who kind of hold the lands that need these interconnections. So if anything, we need more wilderness designations, and we need more parks created, not fewer.
You traveled, as you said, to some of the most rugged and remote places in the U.S. You went to New Mexico, South Dakota, Arizona. What really struck you the most about how the people you met understand wilderness and these issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a hard question, Rose, in a way, because it's so different. Because in a way, you know, wild nature serves as kind of a projection screen for us. People can project their own ideas onto it.
Right.
And I think, you know, probably the place where I saw the most conflict or the biggest differences in thinking would have been in New Mexico, when I went with some folks from Center for Biological Diversity and Defenders of Wildlife to track the Mexican gray wolf, which is the, you know, there's the kind of famous wolves in the Northern Rockies. These are the Northern Rockies' smaller, less well-known, less famous southern cousins. And just as with all the other kind of wolf controversies we've seen over the years, you know, people really project their ideas of wild nature onto this animal. And, yeah, for hunting outfitters and for ranchers, the wolf is essentially an enemy, right? And you know, they don't want it on the land. And for other people, for conservationists and wildlife lovers, having the wolf out there in the landscape really, in the words of the poet Gary Snyder, you know, having predators on the landscape is ecology on the level where it counts, you know, to kind of return those old laws of fang and tooth back to the landscape. So interesting to see how some people just react with a lot of fear. And I think that fear really comes from a fear of loss of control. And on the other end of the ledger, again, some people say, well, that's the idea about wilderness and wildness. We have to give up some control in some places, and sometimes we just have to say, again, we're not gonna let our will dictate this land. And so I think that's what it comes down to is in a way, how comfortable are you with giving up human control over the landscape?
Jason Mark is author of Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. And let's take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Ariane in San Francisco. Hi, Ariane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I want to express a concern about the fundamentalism and the links to eugenics that are sort of filtrating into the conversations that are being had about environmentalism, including in the Sierra Club. There's a plan to clear-cut 500,000 trees in the East Bay Hills at a time of catastrophic climate change. And the nativist movement that the Sierra Club and the developers that are paying for the careers of the mayor and the Oakland City Council members' careers, they're sort of coveting this land, and they're planning on clear-cutting over 10 years 500,000 trees. 500,000 killing of anything would be considered genocide. Certainly it's ecocide. And the way they do this is they state that these trees are invasive, non-native, inflammatory, incendiary, and they denigrate them such that they can be taken away one by one in a way that is less disconcerting. And they use the media to promote the business interests of the people who would love to see the Oakland Hills covered with buildings.
So I guess I would say in response to that, Ariane, and I guess I would share that I think the controversy over the eucalyptus in the East Bay Hills, as well as the eucalyptus here in the city on Mount Sutra behind UCSF, in a way is a kind of a repeat of the oyster controversy. Again, a lot of people have, you know, I think shared values, finding themselves on different sides. To that, I can really only offer a little bit, frankly, of a dodge, Ariane, is that I work for the National Sierra Club. The Bay chapter of the Sierra Club are the folks who really are in charge of that issue. I don't work for the Bay chapter of the Sierra Club. I work for Sierra Club nationally, and I just, you know, I can't really share much more beyond that. But I do think it's an interesting controversy, much like the oyster farm controversy, because it does, you know, raise so much intense passions, and clearly you have those as well.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ariane. I know that KALW News has been covering this, so if you go to KALW.org and search for a keyword, you can find that reporting. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to Natasha in Oakland. Hi, Natasha.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Hello. Wonderful conversation. Listen, I'm in the Diamond Fruitvale area of Oakland, and which is an area, Diamond Park, a lot of trees have been cut down, and it's interesting and sad to see what's going on, you know. My property has been kind of, I don't know, I feel like I've been stalked for the property, and the developers have moved in, and they're taking up and buying up as much as they can, and by any means necessary, it seems. Where I sit, and I believe that land really can't be owned, the property that my house is on is, you know, it's just very magical to me. You know, it's spiritual. I feel like I need to save it somehow, you know. And have you done any work yet? Because once, like, the land is, it's stated it can't be built on, you know, they're, you know, and it's a preserve, then the developers are going to go away, right? At least they'll leave me alone, I would think, because all they want to do is build little condos and more little, you know, just more housing.
I guess I'd, you know, I'd say that, and I'm sorry, first of all, about the kind of pressure you're facing from developers. It's not, you know, it's clearly a big issue throughout the Bay. Luckily, in the Bay, we do have, you know, a pretty strong constellation of local and regional groups trying to preserve open space and trying to make sure that, you know, the development that we're doing is smart development and infill development and not pushing out into new areas. There's the Bay Area Open Space Council. There's groups like the Peninsula Open Space Trust on the peninsula, the Marin Agricultural Land Trust in Marin, Muir Land Trust in the East Bay around kind of Martinez and northeastern Contra Costa County. So the best I can offer, Natasha, is, you know, see if you can find some local open space group there, kind of in what sounds like Southeast Bay or you know, kind of the Oakland, Fremont, Hayward area, and find out who's working there and try to, you know, plug in with them.
Well, thank you for calling in, Natasha. If you'd like to join us, if you have a question for Jason Mark, author of Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on some of these questions? What does wildness mean to you? Does the planet exist for our benefit, or do we have a moral obligation to leave it untamed? This is your call, and we'll be back after this.
This is your call on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. We invite you to join in today's conversation. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We love to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or simply leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up, 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, reveal. Following that, at noon, backstory. And then this afternoon at 1, alternative radio. You're on KALW San Francisco, local public radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about Senator Bernie Sanders' economic platform. A recent study by the University of Massachusetts economist Gerald Friedman says that if Senator Sanders' economic program is enacted, the average income will rise by more than $22,000, the unemployment rate will fall to 3.8%, and the poverty rate will fall to under 6%. So what do you want to know about Senator Sanders' economic policy, and how would it work? That is tomorrow. We are also putting shows together about whose interests are represented in state government. And then we are going to talk about efforts to get more people of color outdoors and in national parks. This has been an ongoing effort for many, many years. And we're hoping to get someone from Afro Outdoors, Jason. And
yeah.
I know that you...
Outdoor Afro. Yeah,
thank you.
Afro.
And
you
went to the Arctic.
I went
with
to the
someone
Arctic.
From Outdoor Afro.
Yes, that was one of the more memorable adventures I took for the book. Myself and a wonderful woman named Rue Mapp, who's a Oakland-based activist and social entrepreneur, started up a group called Outdoor Afro. And Rue's doing really, really important work to ensure. I'm so glad you're doing that show. I think, and I mentioned this in the closing pages of Satellites in the High Country, that's certainly one of, I think, the most pressing challenges to the conservation movement today and the environmental movement is ensuring that the environmental movement reflects the ethnic diversity of this country. So when I think about, you know, there's also a group called Latino Outdoors, mm-hmm. Outdoor Afro, the work that they're doing to ensure that the ranks of people who are engaged in outdoor recreation, again, reflect the ethnic diversity of this country, it's so important. And I'd also put in a plug here. I think, you know, the National Park Service is also trying as best as it can to also do that. You'd think about all the programs actually that they're running at Crissy Field or at, you know, the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, also Death Valley. There's nobody in the environmental conservation movement who doesn't recognize that ethnic diversity, equity, inclusion, and in a sense, you know, racial solidarity is not important. And I think it's about kind of continuing to sort of forge those bonds and those links. So hopefully you'll be able to get Rue on the show.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's on Wednesday. So this trip that you took to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge sound incredible. I mean, this is a place where most of us will never get to visit. What does it look like? What does it feel like?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, few people ever get to go there. And I'll circle back on that because it's really actually important for how we think about wilderness and wildness. So, I mean, you know, we started out in Fairbanks. We flew through the Brooks Range. You don't go over the mountains. You fly through the mountains in a tiny little bush plane, which is sort of a hair-raising experience. Due to weather, we actually had to spend a day and a half in an indigenous community called Arctic Village, which is kind of one of the main communities of the Gwich'in people. The Gwich'in famously have been sort of the main one of the main voices speaking out against drilling in the Arctic plain, because then you kind of go over the mountains and then there's a vast, vast coastal plain that stretches, you know, for a couple hundred miles from the mountains to the seashore. And we spent 4 days rafting down a river called the Aitchilik from the mountains to the plain. And it is truly a magical place. I mean, it almost feels oceanic, right? I mean, there's no trees. It's all flat. And so you almost feel like you're on the ocean. You can almost feel like you can see the curve of the earth. And of course, in June, the sun is up 24 hours a day, which is also bewildering. So it truly is one of those bold-faced names of global wilderness. And yet even there, we saw the, you know, sort of the fingerprints of civilization. The most obvious thing is after 5 days, we raft to the shores of the Arctic Ocean. And what do we find there on the beach but a blue plastic cooler washed up on the shores? And so it was, you know, it was really sort of a punch in the gut to recognize that even at the ends of the earth, you have to engage in a beach cleanup.
Wow. Well, you write that global warming is very obvious there. Permafrost is no longer so permanent. As the ground melts, roads and power lines across the state of Alaska are beginning to buckle and twist. A bark beetle infestation has hammered the state's forests. Warmer winters, longer summers allow the beetles to reproduce more easily. I mean, all you have to do is ask the local people about the changes they're seeing. And they're massive.
Yeah, I mean, it was really quite, I think, emotionally intense talking with some of the Gwich'in, especially the older Gwich'in who've actually been able to sort of have that baseline, that historical baseline, what they've seen in their own lifetimes. Talked with a woman named Sarah James, who's a longtime leader of the Gwich'in, and her brother Gideon. And Gideon, in some ways, is still, you know, following a lot of the old ways. You know, he's still out hunting and fishing on the land. And the stories they shared, you know, of the ice, you know, used to be 4 feet thick in the winter. Now it's 2 feet thick. And some friends of theirs who had actually gone through the ice on their snowmobile while out survived, but, you know, still a frightening experience. And Sarah said something to me. She said, we don't know which way to tell our people to go. You know, they've got essentially a millennium of local wisdom that's based in the land. And then the land changes. And so the question is, yes, kind of which direction do you then go? And so sort of talk. And then, you know, we also then spoke with some Inupiaq people. Some folks might know the Inupiaq as the Eskimo, which is sort of the name they're given by Westerners and Europeans. Talk with some Inupiaq people in a village called Kaktovik, who also had some just really disturbing things to share. I mean, some of them were seeing berries all the way up at the Arctic Ocean, which they'd never seen before. Definitely different precipitation patterns. And so, yeah, if you live in Alaska, and you're really paying attention, you're being, I think, intellectually honest, it's pretty impossible to miss the consequences of global climate change.
And did you talk to them about the changes they would like to see in terms of solutions or policy changes? I mean, is this something that they debate?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Gideon, who for a while served on the Gwich'in Steering Committee, and so he had spent a bunch of time in the lower 48, including in D.C., you know, lobbying against drilling in the Arctic National mm-hmm. Wildlife Refuge. And he said, oh, you know, I see these damn 8-lane and 16-lane highways. I mean, the clear kind of social injustice is that those communities have done really the least to contribute to global climate change, right. In large part because, you know, they've got just kind of a smaller fuel footprint, and yet they're seeing the impacts the most. I think number one kind of policy change they want would be permanent protection for the coastal plain, which, you know, parts of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge are designated wilderness, and so drilling can't happen there. But infamously, and folks will, you know, hopefully remember the kind of 15-year-long running battle against oil drilling in the Arctic Plains, some of it is still open and could see drilling rigs on it. Conservation groups, including the Sierra Club and others, are pushing for President Obama to declare it a national monument, because I don't think we're going to get a parks bill or a wilderness bill through this Congress. But the president can use his authority under the Antiquities Act to designate it a national monument. So that's, I think, what the Gwich'in would most like to see is permanent protection.
Permanent protection. That would be great for his legacy, because up to this point, he's kind of played both sides. He's sort of given the environmentalists a few things, but then he's given the oil and gas industry a lot of things.
Yeah, I think I actually think that's sort of changing. I mean, I think, yes, in his first term, we heard a lot of talk from the White House about an all-of-the-above energy strategy, which of course is not making a choice, and that's what an executive is supposed to do, is make choices. And yet I think in the last couple of years we've seen a real shift in tone from the Obama administration, certainly the denial of the Keystone XL permit, and then you know the decision last year to have a moratorium on coal leasing on public lands. And when you know the president made that announcement, he actually said, or actually when he made the Keystone announcement, said, we're going to have to keep some oil and gas in the ground, which is basically a repetition of the environmental movement's talking points and positions. So I think in this last year, he's a lot more cognizant of his legacy.
Today I'm speaking with Jason Mark. He's an environmental journalist. His new book is Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What does wildness mean to you, and where do we fit in that? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Alicia in Berkeley. Hi, Alicia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm really appreciating the show so much and your guest and his work.
Thank you.
I was in Yosemite recently, and we stopped at Bridalville Falls, and I was really encouraged to see that the parking lot was completely full on a winter day, and that it was a very diverse, you know, population of people who were there. I think many visitors probably from out of the country, but also many people within the country as well. But I would say that 90 to 95% of the people did not venture beyond probably less than a quarter of a mile from the parking lot. And what I'm wondering is, well, my personal experience from having, you know, gone further and gone hiking and camping and stuff is that that's where you really get the value of wildness, is when you're completely away from cars and people and all that. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but I'm just wondering how could we get people to get out there? Because I believe that we are absolutely stewards of the earth and of the creatures that are on it, not just ourselves. But I think that when people have an experience of wildness, then that comes home to them, and also the value to themselves comes home to them. So I'm just really wondering if your guest has thoughts on that. And I also just wanted to tell you that on April 6th, there's going to be a rally at the California State Capitol of many, many groups that are, you know, against fracking, GMOs, lots and lots of environmental issues. And we're going to have a rally with speakers, and then we're going to actually go into the legislature to talk to our state senators and so forth. So anyone who would like to come to that is very welcome. And it's called People for Change Lobby Day. So if you look it up on the net, you can get the details.
Okay. Thank you so much, Alicia.
Yeah, Alicia, thank you so much. And thank you for plugging that April 6th day of action. Yeah, it's a great question. Yes, I mean, well more than half of visitors to the big parks like Grand Canyon and Yellowstone and Yosemite don't go. I think the stat is more than 200 yards from their vehicle or from a parking lot. And yeah, I completely agree with you. In some ways, that's a little discouraging because you're right. I mean, I think to really get these ideas of ecological solidarity at a real gut level, you need to immerse yourself in wild nature. You can get that idea from reading a book, and yes, I hope people buy my book and read it. But fundamentally, you can't experience thinking like a mountain unless you're kind of actually on the mountain. And so there's no substitute for boots on the ground and having that immersive experience where sort of the membrane between us and wild nature kind of slips away just by being at an intimate level with it. At the same time, I think those interactions from the parking lot or, again, from the nearby nature, you know, the Point Reyes National Seashores or the East Bay Regional Parks, those experiences can be like a gateway drug and can draw people in. And then hopefully something sparks and they want to go to the next level of engagement. And then again, hopefully there's some group, whether it's a Outdoor Afro, the National Park Service and its constellation of programs, groups like Bay Area Wilderness Training. Hopefully there's somebody there to then, you know, give people the skills, the confidence, and the equipment to go to the next level if they want to go further. So I agree, you know, it'd be great for people to get a little bit farther from blacktop. But at the same time, I think those experiences can have a real important benefit just as an introduction.
Thank you for calling in, Alicia. We have an email from Laura who says, did you hear about the dog that was attacked and killed by a coyote in San Jose on his own front lawn? What to do? I asked my kids, their ages 8 and 10, and they felt that the people should step back. It seemed that some people are losing sight that man has encroached on animals' territory. Not sure what the city of San Jose is planning to do, but I hope that they don't go on a coyote killing spree. Please discuss. Thank you, Laura. I was thinking about this when you talked about coyotes and mountain lions.
Yeah, Laura, yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And then I agree with your kids, you know, out of the mouths of babes, right? The trick about us, or the trick of the challenge, I guess I should say, of us living and coexisting with wild nature, the onus and the burden of that coexistence is not really on the animals, right, who are just following their own instincts. It's us finding a way to manage our own interests and needs against each other. And I guess I'd hold up as an example the city of Anchorage, Alaska. That's 300,000 people living essentially amidst bear and moose. And they are able to do it quite well. I mean, in some cases, yes, I believe they sometimes, you know, have to euthanize an animal when it's a problem animal. But that's pretty rare, actually, up there, because you've got a civic culture that understands this coexistence. And yes, I mean, coyotes throughout the Mountain West are a real challenge. In some places, mountain lions are a real challenge. You know, the semi-famous or internet-famous P-22, which is the Hollywood lion, the lion that lives in Griffith Park in Los Angeles, last week allegedly took a koala from the Los Angeles Zoo, right? I mean, that's a real kind of challenge there. This animal is just living its own instincts and goes into the zoo and takes a koala. You know, a great example of this, I mean, there are actually more wolves living in Europe right now than there are in the United States, including Alaska. The issue there, again, it's about human coexistence. It's about creating a culture that's willing to sort of balance our needs and interests against the needs, interests, and instincts of those wild animals. And I have to say, I'm kind of caught, notwithstanding the vitriol and the real violence having to do with the wolf controversy in the Mountain West, I'm cautiously optimistic that some communities are getting how to do that balance. And again, I do think for the most part, an example would be here in California, where we've seen a real comeback of mountain lions and cougars. And though there are sometimes, you know, conflicts that do lead to euthanization, for the most part, I think California Fish and Game or California Fish and Wildlife is trying its best to manage those in a non-lethal manner.
Well, thank you for the email. Ron writes, one need not visit the Alaskan wilderness or discuss the larger environmental ethical issues facing all of humanity. Just notice the piles of trash in local streets and highways as indicative and symbolic of humans' lack of respect and reverence for the natural world. And Bernie writes, isn't it oxymoronic for environmentalists to go on a search for wilderness since their presence alone lessens the wildness in wilderness? Maybe certain places like the Arctic should be closed, even to those like Jason, for example, who may see themselves more aligned to the needs of the planet and limited to only indigenous peoples.
That's a great question, Bernie, and it gets it to another thing I know Rose and I want to talk about, which is, does mere human presence necessarily erode wildness, or mean that a place is not wild or wilderness? And this gets into, you know, Rose was asking earlier, you know, what's the new knowledge we have in the last 50 years since the Wilderness Act was passed? And mostly that's having to do with new findings in archaeology and paleobiology showing that humans had spread over just about every part of the continent. And in some ways, we're using landscapes and really managing ecosystems in very fundamental ways before Europeans arrived on the scene. So does that mean it's not wilderness? And so to answer that question, I spent some time among the Oglala Lakota and in the Black Hills of South Dakota, or the Badlands of South Dakota and the Black Hills of Wyoming, to investigate that. And yes, I mean, you know, humans had moved over just about every part of the continent. And yet there is a big difference, right, between pre-Columbian ecosystem management and what we're doing today. And again, I think that difference, again, gets into whether or not the land, kind of capital L, the land and the river, et cetera, is able to still kind of operate according to its own laws. So yes, humans may impact it. I mean, you can have, you know, the Lakota and other plains tribes would have hunted, you know, bison. That's clearly impacting the land. You are you know, killing an animal and using it, or you are, you know, killing a beaver and using it. But there's a big difference between that and, again, industrial civilization. And I think there's a real danger in conflating those two, because I think it actually plays into some of the stuff we hear from conservative and right-wing ideologues saying, oh, well, Native Americans were everywhere. There's no sense in geoengineering the climate. I mean, that's actually a real thing that appeared in the Los Angeles Times by the conservative commentator Jeffrey Goldberg. He said, Indians were everywhere. Therefore, let's geoengineer the climate. I mean, so I think we have to note that there's a big difference, again, between pre-industrial, pre-Columbian ecosystem management and what we see today.
And where are they today, Jeffrey Goldberg?
Right.
I'm glad you brought this up, because you write about the dispossession of the indigenous peoples as being the original sin of the United States. And I think this is really important, especially as we're marking the National Park Act of 1916. You write that there's a very long list about the National Park Service seizing the land. Land grabs occurred in the Northern Rockies, where the Park Service excluded the Shoshone from Yellowstone, and in the Northwest, where Coast Salish names were replaced with English ones, so that a peak long known as Tacoma was rechristened Mount Rainier. Around the Great Lakes, where the stories of the Ojibwa, who lived there for centuries, were not included in the official story of the Apostle Islands National Park. You just go on and on, and I really appreciate this. The removal of the Blackfeet from what is now Glacier is one of the best-known examples of Native American dispossession that occurred in the course of making a nature preserve.
Yeah, I think belatedly the National Park Service is rewriting that history or retelling that history. You know, now I think it's pretty hard to go to a national park and not see some way the kind of the inclusion. We see this in Yosemite Valley, where there's now, you know, a whole Native American museum. And again, that's not sufficient to kind of make up for it. But I do think that hopefully the National Park Service is retelling those stories. But yes, I mean, you can't talk about wilderness and wildness in this country without including the stories of the people who lived here well before Europeans arrived on the scene, which is why I, you know, made an effort, though it, you know, some it maybe wouldn't didn't go as far as it could, but made an effort to make sure that was explored. I mean, one thing I think is so important is that every culture sets aside some places as sacred, places where maybe you don't go and hunt and fish, where you just go to pray, which is pretty similar to our modern idea of wilderness. And the best example of this that's really amazing is Devil's Tower in Wyoming, what the Lakota and the Cheyenne called Bear's Lodge. And it's that monolith of stone that just kind of explodes off of the plains. You know, it was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Well, that was a very important place for the Lakota and the Cheyenne. It was sort of the centerpiece of their star knowledge, right? How they sort of measured the comings and goings of the seasons. And in a sort of nice twist of history, it's the U.S. federal government's first national monument, declared by Teddy Roosevelt. Mm. So what like a wonderful example of how awe crosses cultures, that both of these cultures, though at that point they were really very much warring against each other, and though Teddy Roosevelt was no real friend of the Indians, still awe in that physical place crossed those cultures. So I think it's important to remember that every culture, even though, yes, they're using the land or living with the land, still would have places just to go and pray. And again, I think that's very similar to our modern ideal of wilderness.
One other factoid in your book that I just wanted to read is during a 1915 visit to Washington, D.C., a Blackfeet delegation asked Stephen Mather, the founding director of the Park Service, to at least keep Blackfoot place names in the park. A negotiator named Tail Feathers Coming Over the Hill said the whites used foolish names of no meaning whatsoever. Mather accepted their demand, and then he went ahead and used the white names on the map anyway. It makes me think about the Ahwahnee Hotel, for example, in Yosemite. You walk in there, and there are these massive, beautiful baskets with no description. You have no idea where they were made or where they came from. There's hardly any, there's no information, actually, in that hotel about the Ahwahnee people of Yosemite Valley. And now, if the vendor gets its way, it's going to be called the Majestic Hotel. So even that name, the Ahwahnee, goes away. And I actually want to do a separate show on that. But it's just interesting to look at where we are even today.
And I think, you know, the sort of, you talk about kind of the original sin, or I talk about the original sin of the founding of the Park Service, but it's also kind of the real failure of the Romantic movement to sort of remove landscape out of time, and then you sort of remove the human history of the place. And in her first book, which is really a great book, in Rebecca Solnit's first book, Savage Dreams, she talks about sort of the construction of the myth of Yosemite, and talks about how, yes, it was sort of the people were removed from the history in order to create a place that sort of exists outside of time. That's what the Romantics were trying to do in their way. And again, in some ways, that's, you know, that was really counterproductive, and it did involve a sort of violence, you know, to remove people from the picture and from the stories. And again, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic that we're now returning, if not people directly to the land, because unfortunately that's probably very hard to do, but at least returning stories to the land. And I think that actually creates a more full-bodied experience, actually. I mean, you know, I try to make it a point whenever I go and go to a place and hike outside for many days and sleep underneath the stars, as I like to do, I try to learn some smidgen about the people who live there, again, and, you know, in pre-Columbian eras, because I actually, as an ecologist, I understand the land better, right? To know that the local people were duck trappers or salmon fishers or bison hunters, you learn more about how the land works. And so it's interesting how actually adding back in the layer of human history also creates more ecological literacy.
Yeah, I love that. And you asked this very related and important question in your book. Can we craft a wilderness ideal that is deepened rather than demolished by historical awareness?
And I think we can. And I think that's actually one of the big tasks for the conservation movement going forward, is to kind of hold – it's a trick, right, to kind of hold in your head all of this knowledge and often the atrocities of history, and still hold in your heart a reverence for place. I think we can do that. I think we can walk and chew gum. It is hard, again, to sort of hold both those things in head and heart at the same time, but I think we can do it.
Well, thank you for including that history, because it's so important. Jason Mark is author of Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. Jason, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Rose. It was good fun.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about Senator Bernie Sanders' economic platform. A recent study by the University of Massachusetts economist Gerald Friedman suggests that if Senator Sanders' economic program is enacted, the average income will rise by more than $22,000, the unemployment rate will fall to almost 3.8%, and the poverty rate will fall to under 6%. So what do you want to know about Senator Sanders' economic policy? Join the conversation with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihei Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.